Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are continuing with our mythology series. We are almost all the way through season three, Jen.
Woo!
We will be discussing Piper Maru in our mythology series. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that one, let's hear our tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our lovely interview with Jim and Kelly Thornton of the X-Files Preservation Collection. And a lot of interesting little tidbits we picked up during that interview. And the listeners obviously enjoyed it as well. Kathy G said, what a delightful interview. I loved hearing how Jim and Kelly connected with Chris Carter. Enjoyed meeting with them at X-Fest. And I'm looking forward to visiting their expo when they open. Very nice, Kathy. That's cool that Kathy was able to meet up with Jim and Kelly at X-Fest. I suspect they made a lot of connections there.
I can't wait to go to X-Fest someday.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you haven't been yet, have you?
I haven't been able to go, but...
No, neither have I. I mean, I say that as though you haven't been yet, but neither have I, so...
I plan to. It's on the list.
Yeah. I spent so much money on going to conventions in like 2018 that I had no money left after that. And so, yeah, working my way back up to going to X-Fest. But it's a great opportunity to meet very cool X-Files people like Kathy G and Jim and Kelly. Isidub said, great interview. Jim and Kelly are doing an amazing job. I've already supported them and have the cap, t-shirt, and mug. I'm sure many files would be happy to help them even once again for all the restoration work. Maybe I'll visit one day, but I'm so far away. I hear you, Isidub. It's I think Isidub's way over there in France, I do believe, so that's a long way to go, but hopefully all of our file fans from around the world eventually make their way over to X-Fest and to the X-Files preservation collection display when they manage to make that happen, which I hope will be very, very soon. From Like a Kid in a Candy Store. Thanks, Annie and Jen. Really enjoyed listening to this interview. I have great admiration of Jim and Kelly for this huge undertaking they did in preserving the X-Files props. Seriously, the X-Files deserves to have a museum. So applause emojis, Jim and Kelly. Totally agree with you on that one, Like a Kid in a Candy Store. I mean, just the scope of the props. Project Annie is like so impressive, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, how many shows do this? Like how many shows have such a huge following and all of these items saved in order to be able to do something like this? It is really special. It's really amazing.
It's amazing that that Chris Carter and others saved this stuff, and amazing the time and effort and passion that Jim and Kelly have put into that. It just blows me away, but that's X-Files fans for you, man. We are an enthusiastic bunch. Like a Kid in a Candy Store also added on, I have to let Jim know I was cheering when he said he loves shapes. So do I. I'm really into werewolves. And in my humble opinion, shapes is no slouch. Makeup department did a good job there. Well, Annie, you and I don't necessarily agree strongly on this one with Like a Kid in a Candy Store and with Jim, but... this is, to me, evidence of what I say from time to time, which is, you know, my least favorite X-File is probably someone's favorite. And this is like proof of that, because that was literally one of my least favorite X-Files.
I mean, I have to stand corrected. I mean, sometimes you watch something and you're like, how could anyone like this? And then you find out, wow, okay, guess folks like this. I guess I need to just sit back and let folks like this. Because look, if that's what you dig, then you be you. Folks,
I think it's great. Yeah. I think, you know, and it just kind of it exemplifies how the X-Files means different things to different people, and different people appreciate different aspects of it, because the X-Files is so many things. You know, it's sci-fi, it's horror, there's romance, there's character stuff, there's plot driven stuff. It just covers a lot of territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it appeals to so many different people. Some of us are there for the shipping and the mythology, and some people are there for the monster of the week and the horror. It's all different, which is, you know, the awesome thing about the X-Files.
Well, you know, we've talked before about how, you know, Tezos Dos Bichos is one of those universally hated episodes also. And yet it's like I cannot find myself hating it just because of that Scully line about the partial rat body part. Right. And in a weird way, like, even though I really can't stand Shapes and I would never watch it by choice, like, I literally would never watch it unless I was, like, doing a rewatch and I felt compelled to watch every single episode. That's the only reason that I would ever watch it. But I there's a part in it that I do think is funny because I just always remember seeing this Tumblr post where somebody quoted the main character, who's the guy who was on Twin Peaks? I'm trying to remember his name. We couldn't remember last time either. We're terrible. But Mulder goes up to him and he's like, do you believe in shape-shifting? And the guy goes, sir, we're at a funeral. Or is it something like that? And it's like, it's not necessarily probably meant to be that funny, but it's,
no, I don't think it's, it is.
Yeah, it's kind of like the whole Mulder jumping on the train thing, like this Tumblr post made it funnier, and then it kind of elevated in my mind into like this really kind of great moment. And I mean, that's the only positive thing I can take out of Shapes, but it's something.
That's
it's
great.
It's funny and it's
like
great.
That,
yeah, it's a nice little moment. So
I like that, you know. And the makeup actually was on point, I think, in Shapes. So I will give credit there. And if that's, you know, I don't generally really notice that sort of thing because I'm not like a horror fan, but horror fans, I'm sure, notice that sort of thing when it comes to like makeup and effects and things like that. They're not as important to me, but I can see that for other folks that matters a lot. And hey, you know, to each his own, that's great. I'm sure that everyone who made Shapes is thrilled that there's people out there that love it.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled that there's people out there that love it because, you know, every episode there's someone that loves it. And it just goes to show, you know, they really did their best with every episode. And for some of us, it fell short, but for someone, it still really worked.
Right.
And I think that's awesome.
And, you know, at the end of the day, too, it's not like one of those, you know, inherently offensive episodes like Babylon or a first person shooter
get me into that. Yeah, no, it just for me, it just fell short of the mark. But
yeah,
I think it's great that for some people, you know, they just have different criteria and that's great. So I think it's awesome. I love it. I love the fact that there's such a variety of where people fall on certain episodes.
You know, if nothing else, Jen, we've set a record today for the longest that you and I will ever sit and talk about Shapes. So
I think it might be. I think it was good. I think there was, it was kind of like a really sort of philosophical discussion about it, which I really enjoyed, and about sort of the nature of fandom and nature of the creation of the X-Files, which was really, we put a lot into Shapes more than perhaps we would normally have done. So thanks to Like a Kid in the Candy Store for bringing that back up. So gave us a chance to discuss that. It was very cool.
Absolutely.
And thanks to everyone for tweeting at us this week and every week. We appreciate seeing you on Twitter. We are at XFD Podcast and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Piper Maru.
Hmm.
All right. Well, Jen, you know the origin of this name, of this ship, correct?
Yes. Not a ship is not the MSR ship, but it is an actual like sailing ship,
exactly.
A boat on the sea.
Yes.
I mean, I find it interesting because traditionally, I think most people probably know that Piper Maru is Jillian's daughter's first and middle names, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I think Piper Maru is sort of almost the professional name she goes by. That's what she calls herself on her website, I noticed today.
Yeah.
Which is very sweet that, I mean, Chris Carter's like her godfather, right?
Correct.
And so it was probably his idea to name the ship after her. It's what I find also really curious about it, and which threw me off for a long time, is that Maru is the word used to affix to names of Japanese ships. So a lot of like Japanese merchant ships are named the whatever Maru.
And really?
So it's yes. And so for a long time, I always thought that the name of this boat was the Piper part came from Jillian's daughter. And the Maru just came from the fact that maybe the boat they were using was a Japanese boat. And that's why it was called the Piper Maru. So it's a very interesting coincidence that Maru just happened to also be her name. So just thought I'd mention that because it kind of blows my mind. Apparently, the Japanese word maru roughly translates as circle, and there's like about five or six different theories as to why that wound up being used to pop onto ship names.
But that is
the way it is.
I actually didn't know that. I mean, I knew that like I knew that was the name of her daughter, but I had no idea that it had the connection to an actual ship. I just thought that was totally random. You know what though? Now that you say this, you're gonna laugh at this reference, but maybe people will know Maru is like the most famous YouTube cat. Does anybody know this?
I did not know Maru, the famous YouTube cat.
Okay, you need to look up Maru, the famous YouTube cat, because he is the cutest cat, and clearly, you know, he lives in Japan. It's a Japanese name, but I had no idea. I'd never really made the connection until you started saying that. And then I'm like, that's that cat from those YouTube videos. It's Maru.
There you go.
And that you said that means circle? That's really cool.
Yeah, apparently that's the Japanese word for circle, but there's like different theories about why they use it for ship names. Like a circle is like a trip where you go out into the world and come back again. That's the circle. Or the circle is somehow indicating like the sort of removed world of the ship, a world in and of itself in its own circle. There's lots of different theories about it. Wikipedia couldn't make up its mind, so
right.
I'm just rolling with it. But I remember the time the word Maru did mean ship to me. I knew that for some reason. And so I always thought that had no clue that Maru was actually part of Piper's name as well. So maybe Jillian wanted to name it. Maybe this is like a common concept in Japanese that she was taken with or something. I'm not sure where she used the name Maru from.
And I don't, this is complete and utter speculation, but you know, she has a tattoo on her wrist. That's a circle.
She does. That's right.
And
maybe that's for her daughter.
I wonder. I'm starting to think that could possibly be what that is.
That's got to be connected. Yeah.
Right?
Because
if it's not, that's an insanely crazy coincidence. I'm sure that all like the Jillian stans out there are screaming at me. Of course it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sorry, I didn't know.
Screaming at both of us. We don't know. So please enlighten us on Twitter.
But that would be cool if that's what it
is. For us.
Love that.
So yeah, I've always been kind of like blown away by how well that worked.
Mm-hmm.
In the context
it's
of
like,
this episode.
Yeah, because the baby would have been born early season two, and this is a good year and a half later, or maybe they were writing the script a year later. So it's like Chris Carter's just like waiting around for like a ship to name after, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, that's crazy, but I love it. Okay.
Yeah, wow. It's awesome.
I learned something new
Piper
today.
Maru.
Here we are, 5 minutes in, and we've just been talking about the name. But hey, I love it.
It's really interesting to me.
I find that fascinating.
Cool.
Thank you for that update. All right. Well, let's start the episode, shall we?
Okay. Yes, let's.
So we are starting here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, latitude 42 north, 171 east. I looked this up because I was just very curious where it fell. I know we did this before when we were talking about EBE, where we actually like looked up the latitudes and the longitudes that they were talking about, and it actually tracked and made sense. And we were whoa, holy shit. But this one wasn't like super exciting because it was just like Pacific Ocean, and it's literally like in the middle of the Pacific. So it's...
Right.
I don't know what sort of significance that has other than to the connection to Nisei, which we'll be talking about later. But so this is where the ship is. And we are introduced to our sort of cold open, I don't know, kind of protagonist, I guess, Gaultier. It's a French salvage ship. And they're out there looking for this. What we find out later is a P-51 Mustang, right?
Yes.
And they what they discover is obviously these high levels of radiation, which we have seen before in sort of surrounding sort of the UFOs or the alien technology. This radiation is something that has definitely come up before. And then I don't know if this is important, but the numbers JTT011 470. Did you find any 1013 connections here that I'm not aware of?
Yeah, I don't. It's everything. Usually, you know, numbers and letters on the X-Files always mean something, but there was nothing about that I could really make any particular sense of.
Yeah, I was just curious if you came up with something that
I didn't.
But yeah, it was
maybe
weird.
One of the listeners will know that.
Maybe
one.
It was weird to see a number that wasn't necessarily like connectable to 1013 or something. But anyway, so. This is the first time we are seeing the black oil officially.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. Unless
we count that brief split second we saw it in Ice, which I'm going to sit here and count it because tracks, yo. It really does. I mean, right? It does. It's like buried in the earth and it's the alien and hey, why not? I'm assuming...
No, this is the first time that it's sort of officially introduced, like you say.
Yeah, yeah. And I think at this point, too, they are doing different things with it than they do later in Fight the Future and even to an extent in season four. But I feel like they're kind of sort of figuring out, like, what are we going to do with this oil stuff? This is kind of cool. Let's figure this out. But I do like the idea that, like, this alien purity or substance, whatever we want to call the black oil, is alive in the earth, just buried deep down. And so we see it here. We see it in Fight the Future in Texas. Mm-hmm. You know, we see it coming to the surface. And I like the idea that, like, it's like the truth can't stay buried. You know, it's going to come up. And I don't know. I just like the idea that it's ancient. Like, it's always been here and it's just going to come out. I think that's really kind of fascinating and awesome.
So, like, beware of disturbing it.
Right. So clearly this black oil, because the guy dives down, finds this dude in the sub, or not in the sub, in the plane.
That is such a creepy scene. I mean, when he gets down there and first you hear the noise, the bang, 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 and then he sees there's a guy alive, apparently, in this World War II plane. That is a very cool and scary scene.
Very cool and scary. And I mean, I'm going to ask you this because it is obviously odd that this dude is still alive down in the plane. I'm assuming that the black oil has obviously kept this guy alive this entire time. And which is interesting and not really something I've ever considered before, that, like, that this black oil essentially can, it's got almost like an immortality vibe to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which comes into play later with the chip and all of that other stuff.
Absolutely. Which is cool. I think that there's a question to a certain extent of, like, who is that? I mean, he obviously was a pilot, but he has become, he is now a host to the Black Oil, and it's a bit unclear at this point. It seems like in this episode, the black oil kind of, like, it's like a body snatcher situation where it basically takes you over. So it's like the black oil was still alive and just using that body as a host, but that the black oil obviously can keep its host alive in very sort of, like, non-survivable situations, but the black oil can survive, and it obviously has some kind of a power to keep its host alive for a long time. And it seems that the only reason it was stuck where it was stuck was he just couldn't get out. He's been waiting down there, he being the black oil, inside his pilot host
for another host for a chance jump into.
For another host, we could see that he couldn't get out. You know, he's banging on the canopy of the plane.
Right.
And if he could have gotten out, maybe he would have swum to the surface or something like that. But he is, I guess, limited by the powers of the host that he is in to a certain extent. And so he was stuck down there. And then lo and behold, here is a helpful, friendly diver after many decades come down to give me a lift back to the surface.
Well, it makes me think, too, like, it's clear that the black oil can't jump. It needs a human host, essentially, to jump. Like, it can't.
It does.
It can't travel jump into a fish or or a dolphin or a passing piece of seaweed.
It can't just float up as like a little oil patch. It needs a host. Now, how it actually gets from person to person is not at all clear in this episode because, I mean, there's a lot of layers of glass between the pilot and the diver, but somehow it gets in there.
I was going to ask about that because clearly we know, I mean, and I don't think that's necessarily inconsistent because we see in, I believe, Tunguska or Terma, we'll talk about it later, it clearly can get through the suit. Yeah. It can get through the kid's rubber shoe in Fight the Future. Yeah. So it's not like this black oil is like, it can totally get through glass or whatever it wants to do, but it can't do that unless there's a host to jump into. Yeah. That's kind of where I'm sitting with this.
It needs some kind of proximity, I assume, to this host. It can. There's not a lot of physical barriers, but it can't go forever without something to go immediately into.
Correct. And it makes also kind of is the implications of this as terrifying as what we see throughout the episode, as it jumps from host to host and then it sort of leaves the prior host alive.
Yeah.
So this
and okay,
this,
more or less.
Yeah, this poor fucking guy is trapped down below in a plane, and he's just gonna die down there, and that makes me very sad.
Yeah. Yeah, that is sad,
and we don't really deal with that, but it happened.
We don't at all, and it's very it's very disturbing. Like, I'm quite disturbed when I think about like what degree of consciousness did he have during that period, like those decades of being trapped down there.
Not
and
much,
then, like you say. And then once the oil leaves, it seems that the previous host is left with complete awareness of their situation. So that would have been pretty awful as well. So it's a pretty terrifying situation all the way around. I mean, I just anything to do with like being buried alive or anything like that totally creeps me out. And this definitely falls in that category.
It's almost one of those things that I feel like they could have pushed harder and made a thing like in the cold open and made that terrifying. But again, it's so much that they're throwing at you that I understand that it's more important that we focus on the fact that this black oil has now transferred itself to Gauthier, and he's now back on the ship and headed back to the mainland, and we're all in fucking trouble essentially.
And we're and it's still a mystery at that point about what is happening here.
Exactly.
So it's just, you know, makes total sense that it's just this scary mystery at this point. It's just the cold open, so we definitely want to keep scary mystery as the vibe.
Yeah, but great cold open, really cool cold
so
open.
Great. And I mean, I just want to say the black oil effect, which changes a little bit in iteration over the years, it always looks amazing to me. I mean, from the beginning, it's very scary and quite unique looking, really, and very effective. So I think they did a cool, cool job with that.
Yeah, it doesn't look like how you would think the black oil would react, like in an eyeball. Like, you know, if you see, if you get like a burst capillary or something, and like the blood just kind of goes in and it's like kind of gross. But you'd think that it would look something like that, but it's nothing like that. It's like almost like this mist. Like it looks inhuman, which is, I think, the point. And I think it's I agree with you completely. It's a great effect. Love it.
Very, you know, very still imaginative. Very effective. Well done. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we are back at the FBI. I had to give a shout out to Kimberly because at this point, Skinner's secretary is still Kimberly. I don't know I don't know when Kimberly turns into Arlene Skinner, aka Mitch Pileggi's wife, but
maybe things didn't work out with Kimberly. Maybe because she was randomly calling people and telling them things about Skinner's medical condition when she ought not to have. I don't know.
She told everyone about that hooker and then he let her go.
She has loose lips. I think you can't have that as a personal assistant.
But let's keep our eye on Kimberly. I'm going to start a Kimberly watch because I want to know when Kimberly disappears.
Let's keep an eye on Kimberly and see how many more times she pops up, how many lines she ever actually gets. She got a yes, sir, at the beginning in her first scene here.
She's
why they're having
earning that sag card.
Why Skinner and Scully are having this conversation in his reception area, I don't know. Why they didn't just, if it's, you know, get out of here, lady. We're having a private conversation.
Yeah.
Why not just walk into your office, dude, and have it in there?
Plus, this is really upsetting information. And, like, it does make me think, like, how much information does Kimberly get and then just go home and tell her friends? Like, man, like, Skinner's really got the hots for this chick in our office, and it's so obvious, but nobody can tell. But like, I just want to know like everything from her POV. Like, what does she make of all of this? It's just fascinating.
Someone needs to write a fanfic from Kimberly's POV. It'd be very interesting, actually.
I love that idea. So this scene, I think, is such a good. This might be my favorite Jillian scene in the whole episode, and it's like the first scene. I just wrote, damn, Scully's retort is chef's kiss. Because, really, that's all there is. I love the idea that, like, she knows that Skinner's on her side, but she still can't quite mask her disappointment and her frustration. And you know Skinner is right there with her. Like, that's what's... Mm-hmm. It's frustrating because his hands are tied, you know, as usual. He can only do so much. But he's with her. Like, he gets it. And I love what she says about the idea of, like, everything... Every fascinating thing that the FBI can do to sort of figure out who the killer is and what's his issue with his mother and is he a bedwetter? Like, they can do all of this shit, but no. And she pulled out everything like it was a well-lit apartment. They left the murder weapon.
Yes.
But still, nothing.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, exactly. And I love it when she says... It has everything to do with interest, just not yours and not mine. I love that line. And I love the fact that she does include him in that, that they are both being left out of the loop on this.
Yeah.
And she delivers it so well. You're right. She delivers that whole scene beautifully. Mm-hmm. She just that sort of combination of like heartbreak and anger. And she nails everything with what she's saying and just beautifully done. So I love that scene. It's a great scene. I love Scully and Skinner together. And that's a prime scene.
I have a question to posit to you because this gave me some thoughts. The fact that Scully is not either able or willing to look into this herself, the way that Mulder has been into his own sister's disappearance, it's a different situation, but Mulder has been very, very vocal and open about actively looking into his sister's case, regardless of whether it's active or not. But Scully doesn't seem to be doing that. And I'm not sitting here blaming Scully. I mean, there are other people whose job this is, but she seems very, very frustrated and much more apt to just be like, well, I guess that's just the way things are. And I think that's actually very fitting for her character. Mm-hmm. But it's slightly frustrating because I feel like I wish that she could sort of pull a Mulder and be like, well, I'm going to look into this shit myself. Yeah. And it makes it all the more upsetting that she goes down to the office, to the basement, and Mulder asks what's wrong, and she doesn't tell him.
Yeah.
And we don't really, I think that part of this isn't resolved until the next episode, which we'll get to next time. But I found that rather frustrating and rather interesting that not only is she not going to look into this herself, she's not even going to tell Mulder, who would most definitely want to look into this himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so what do you think about that?
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think you're right. It is somewhat in character for Scully to want to go through official channels. And I think that might well be why she doesn't tell Mulder. I don't like it when Scully and Mulder keep secrets from each other. It hurts my heart. And so I assume it's not that she doesn't want to share with him, but that she doesn't want him to go off the rails and be all like, hey, we got to investigate this ourselves. My sort of feeling, my sort of impression theory was that Scully knows she could very well go off and investigate this herself, and she probably has some very clear ideas about what went on here, but that to her that maybe that would feel like a hollow victory. She doesn't want to find out for herself what the truth is. She wants justice, and she only wants justice to happen through the normal channels that justice happens. So that would be through the police and the FBI. Her finding the killer wouldn't give her any sense of closure or to give her anything that she wants. She's not interested in going out and like killing the person who killed her sister or something like that. She probably already has a clear sense of the truth. I think she says as much in Paperclip when Melissa dies, that I know what the truth now I want is
answers.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you. So she does know already what the truth is. And so she just wants somebody else to believe that, to come to their own conclusions, and for whoever has done this to pay in sort of the right way in her perspective, which is for justice to be served in an official capacity.
Yeah.
So that's the way I look at that. She just does things differently from Mulder, because Mulder would definitely be all like, I'm going to go and kill that guy. And that's just not how Scully operates. And she doesn't really want to drag Mulder into it, I think.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I completely agree with what you're saying. But it's like Scully is far more interested in the world learning the truth. And like, you know, that's the scientist in her. Like, this can change the world. Mm-hmm. This is important. I want justice. Like, all these very, very big, big ideas. Yes. Whereas I feel like Mulder is far more interested in finding it for himself and finding it for Scully. Like, I would say he just wants to know for himself. He honestly, I think he could give a fuck about the rest of the world knowing. Yeah. He just wants the proof for himself because he wants to prove it to Scully. And I feel like that part of it grows throughout the series. But I just find that really interesting that like they're not necessarily their motivations, but like their ideal outcomes are slightly different, I think.
Yeah. I think that's a really great point and a great question that you posited, because I think it really does illustrate a significant difference between them in terms of the search for the truth and the reason behind it. And yeah. I think you're absolutely right that Scully is fueled by the scientist in her, because science is all about proof and evidence and publishing your results. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way she operates. She wants the world to know, and she wants it to be done in such a way that it's believable and unequivocal. And and you're right, for Mulder, it's much more personal. It's all about, because he's been so driven by this personal cause since he was a kid. He's grown up and developed around it, so that he's just about a personal truth, whereas Scully is more about sort of a worldly truth.
And I think that can explain why their thresholds are different. Like, she needs more than he does.
Yes.
Because he just needs it for himself. She needs it for everyone. She needs it for her reputation. Yep. She needs it for the world. She needs everyone to be able to believe this. And he's just like, I saw it. I believe it. Like, I don't care what other people think.
It's enough for me.
Exactly. And I love that sort of dynamic. And I feel like that's really kind of well illustrated here. So,
yeah, that's a great point. Because, the bar for proof in the scientific world is very high.
Yeah.
And, totally different from just, seeing is believing, good enough for me, which is, Mulder's way of operating. And, Scully probably believes that to a certain extent, too. But that, like you say, that's not her goal.
Yeah.
And her goal just requires a much higher bar of proof.
And I think that's why she can be frustrating yet believable, because I think there are lots of things that she does believe that she saw, but she can't prove it. And so it's going to be very hard for her to go around like Mulder would and be like, I saw a UFO. I saw it. Like, because she doesn't have anything to back it up. So it's like, a lot of the time when we think Scully is just denying something or saying she doesn't believe it, I don't necessarily think that's entirely the case. I think it's just she can't go, quote unquote, I mean, I'm talking about Fight the Future at this point. She can't go to OPR and say, I saw a UFO. Like, she can't do that. Even though in her mind, I think she knows she saw it. Mm-hmm. So it's just again, that threshold of proof that they both need. And I think that works. I think it works for her. I think it makes sense, especially in watching her grow and watching her, the way that she deals with the things that she believes and the things that she sees and what she shares with others. I think that's really a really cool arc that we see with her that we don't necessarily see with Mulder, because we don't need to. So
exactly. And this is a great example of that. So well pointed out.
Well, thank you. So Mulder tells her about the Talipus has reemerged, essentially. It's the same ship. And I love the fact that he name dropped that, because it was a direct connection to Nisei, which we were just watching. It's the same area. They're all looking in the same area. And he's like, why are they doing this now? What information are they acting off of? And what we find out later is they're acting off of Krycek's information that he got back in, was that fucking
Paperclip,
two?
I think?
Was it Paperclip? Yeah, it would have been Paperclip.
That he got the digital tape.
Yeah. Yeah, he got the digital tape. And that digital tape is essentially where all of this information is coming from.
Yeah. So I really like the way they're bringing some strands together here. The digital
tape.
The location of the ship from Nisei. I enjoy me some continuity, and so I really like this.
And I think it's very easy to watch this episode and be like, okay, well, I guess they found that. Okay, I guess they found that. Because a lot of the times when I watch these mythology episodes, I don't have my brain turned on that way, and so I'm not like trying to think about how it connects. I'm just like, okay, well, okay, I guess they found it. Great, okay. But the fact that it really does, and it's very, very, it's just barely hinted at. It's, again, the answers are there. You just have to know where to look. Everything does connect. It's just, there's so much information coming at you that often it's easy to miss stuff.
Yeah, I honestly never noticed really that part about the Talipus and the fact that he's literally talking about something that happened in the previous mythology two-parter. I don't think I ever really clicked that there's that connection. I mean, it's very clear. I don't know why I didn't put it together, but I was just like, what's happening with Mulder and Scully right now?
Yeah.
So but it's definitely... It's very clear once you start looking for it.
I mean, we'll see when we get into Apocrypha what we think, but like, I really felt like this episode was a lot more solid in terms of just the mythology sort of making sense and lining up more than Nisei 731. That was just my initial thinking, especially considering that they're introducing an entirely new element to the mythology, which is the black oil. I thought that they did a really good job with that.
I think, yeah, I tend to agree that this is a relatively straightforward story. It's not overly dense, certainly the Piper Maru part at least. And I think that's important. You kind of need that when you are introducing this new element. So I think they were judicious in how they did it. And I think they did a good job with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they bring up, I think, some elements throughout later that like kind of get dropped, but not entirely, like not enough for me to be like, well, that made no sense. Like, I get it. And we'll get to those things, I promise.
Yes.
So they go off to San Diego, correct? And they to check out this ship. But first, they want to check out all these victims who are clearly suffering from these radiation burns that nobody knows why. And this guy, Dr. Sizer, yet again, another instance of some male doctor looking at Scully like, why are you asking me this question? Do you have a tiny lady brain? What's wrong with you? And then,
how do you know these words?
Yeah. And then Scully's like, bitch, I'm a doctor. I love every time she gets to tell a man that she's a medical doctor, because it's just like, and again, this is the show, I think, being very self-aware. And I know people give this show a lot of shit all the time for misogynistic elements, but like, we're reminded consistently that they are very aware that Scully is this woman in a man's world, and they get to play with that, and they do it many, many times. And I just need to point it out every time it happens. It's very much Scully holding her own, telling these men, hey, hello, talk to me. Yeah. I am your colleague. Okay.
Yeah.
And I really, really appreciate every time they do that, because it's not like a slight at Scully. It's telling the viewer, hey, this is what women fucking deal with. Like, and I really appreciated that. I liked that little moment.
I think you're right that it's very subtle, but I think it does tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Very subtle. It's just a tiny moment, but it's there.
Yeah. Yep.
So they get onto the ship. They say that there's no radiation left on the ship. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, I was trying to think this through, like, what do you make of that? Because clearly the radiation showed up, and then when maybe the radiation only exists when the black oil is around, but then does that mean that when the black oil is like in Gautier or whoever, that like they're exposing everyone they go by? Or
that's a very, very good question. Yeah. I think that, I mean, when Gautier first is brought back up to the ship, there doesn't seem to be any concern about radiations. No one's freaking out like, oh, my God, the radiation levels. But we see later on in the episode, and we'll get to it, when Gautier's wife was walking around black oiled up, she like is got some kind of super radiating power.
Yeah.
Where she can like flash radiation at people. So maybe Gautier did that at some point.
Yeah, it seems like it's intentional. Like, they can do it. It's not something that just happens. It's almost like a weapon. Like, I'm gonna flash my Wonder Woman powers and then make everyone get ugly burns. Like, it's almost like, okay, it's gonna do it. Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna assume that's the case. That like,
that's what I kind of took from it in the end, is that, and it was really only when because I watched it twice this week, and it was only my second time through that I thought, oh, I bet you it's like what the wife does later. Mm-hmm. That must be how all those guys wound up with radiation, because they seem totally fine at first when he comes up, and then they're totally not fine. So something.
Yeah.
And that happened before they got back to shore, because the doctor says that Gautier was the only person who was even capable of piloting the boat.
Exactly.
So,
but
it happened suddenly.
I had to go down a rabbit hole today and like look up radiation, because I actually don't know much about radiation. It occurred to me today that I'm like, I don't really fucking know anything about radiation. I mean, I know it's like a thing and it's bad, and I don't really know what it is. And there are different kinds of radiation. And it strikes me, though, that is very odd that there can be a sort of radioactive event and then there is no remaining radiation on the ship. So I think we can chalk that up as Mulder would to just being fucking weird and alien, because that's pretty much where he's at, I think.
Yes.
But
he's at one point says not on this earth. At least. There's obviously a theory, because it is such an intense level of radiation with the sailors, that something not of this world has befallen them.
Yeah. And I think it's important, too, that like Mulder is clearly clued in to the little parts of the story that don't add up. Like, even later when Scully's like, well, it's clearly just a nuclear weapon. It's an atomic bomb, blah, blah, blah. And I think Mulder knows, like, OK, but if that's the case,
how was there no radiation on that guy? How was there no radiation on the ship? Like, he can think, he's thinking it through one step further. In that
he's a bit more skeptical about the story. You know, Scully gets the story. It more or less sounds believable from a source that she believes. And so she readily takes it. But in this case, Mulder's actually the one who's sort of bringing a few more skeptical ideas and questions to the table.
Yeah. And it's funny, is like, I wouldn't necessarily say skeptical. I would just say he's more open to other possibilities. Whereas Scully is like, this tracks for me. So we're done.
Yep.
And
close enough. Case closed.
Yep. And it's just interesting the fact that like that story does line up in a very convenient way for the case to be closed.
Absolutely.
And that's the way that it's designed.
Yeah, it's a believable story, and I'm sure we'll get to that in more detail.
Yeah. So we have Mulder on the ship, of course, touching and smelling everything, as Mulder loves to do.
I mean, it's just as well that that oil doesn't just leap into your body the second you come in contact with it, because he's touching that oil all over the place.
Yeah, the whole episode. Like, every single time he's like, what's this goop? No, but it's true. He's very lucky. I mean, he isn't so lucky next season, but we'll get to that later. I have a feeling, and this is also, I think, rather consistent all the way up through, what's that one in season 8? Vienen, where they're on the oil rig. After the black oil exits the host, they're always left with sort of this oily film residue on them that is it's no longer dangerous. It's just kind of like the after effect of it.
Yes, so it's inert in some fashion.
Exactly. And so it's luckily for Mulder, I don't think this oil is going to do anything to him. But
not that he knew that, but he was ready to dive in.
He doesn't care. He's just going to eat it.
Though. He's always touching things and smelling them and tasting them and all kinds of wrong things.
He didn't eat this. I shouldn't say that.
We should for once.
He does eat very weird things, though.
He's an odd fellow.
He's quite odd. But that's why we love him. Coming up is probably the greatest, definitely the greatest MSR moment in the episode. Probably my favorite moment in the episode, because why would it not be?
I think you know what I'm going to say. With this. Yeah.
They're looking at the video from the diver, and Scully immediately is like, that's a P-51 Mustang. And David, I'm sorry. Wow, Freudian slip.
Yeah, maybe.
Mulder just immediately aroused by this. And I'm not even, you know, lying, because he literally tells her he just got very turned on.
Yeah.
I kind of got turned on, too. I found that incredibly hot that she was just like, yeah, I know what that is. And I love the idea anytime. And let me tell you, Jen, anytime that they play up the idea that smart is sexy, that it's not necessarily anything she did or said or how she looks or anything. It's what she knows. What she knows gets him going. And I love that.
That is true. Yeah, that's awesome, isn't it? That's so great. Mm-hmm. I love that. It's a strange thing to say when you have a third person in the room, which they did in this case. I mean, God knows what that Navy guy thought, who's right there.
Oh, he thought they were fucking, just like everybody else.
Yeah. He must have, right? Because we know Mulder and Scully. It's the kind of thing Mulder says. Either he thought they were fucking, or he thought that Mulder was the worst sexual harasser that he's ever come in contact with.
Just so incredibly inappropriate. But Scully just blows right past it. But I love the look she gives him. It's just kind of like, really? Like, really? Right. People are fucking dying of radiation burns, yo. I her face is priceless. It's so good.
It's awesome. I agree. It's a great moment. And I did my own little experiment. My husband also makes model airplanes from World War II. And so just to check the veracity of the likelihood that Scully would be able to identify this plane with very little actual footage and quite grainy, I showed it to him and he's like, oh yeah, it's a P-51 Mustang. So it's very,
it's believable.
It's very believable. It's an it's very identifiable by its canopy, its cockpit. Mm-hmm. It's a bubble canopy, apparently. Also, FYI, little minor thing, when Scully says it's a North American P-51 Mustang, I just assumed she meant like it's a P-51 Mustang from North America, but actually North American my husband informs me, is the name of the company that made the P-51 Mustang. So that's just, she knows even more. She knows the name of the company that made it, and she knows the plane. So it's a North American P-51 Mustang. She's very well informed about this plane.
It's another good example. It reminds me of in Blessing Way, or whenever that was, maybe it was Anasazi, when she was just like, she knew about the code talkers, the Navajo code. And it was completely believable because they have set up that she would know all of this stuff.
Yeah, believable. And you know, we it's totally believable to me that Scully would have been hanging around her brothers and her dad while they're doing this. She probably wanted to sort of get involved too, but they're like, this is just for boys. But, you know, Scully's not going to be put off by that. She was hanging around, picking up all the details, obviously, because she knew right away. The Navy guy was pretty impressed too, I think. He's like, yeah, it sure is. So everyone in that room was turned on, I think, by Agent Scully at that moment.
Love it. Love it. Mm-hmm. I love those moments where she gets to sort of, you know, be in the boys club. I love it when the girl gets to show off.
Yep.
I enjoy it.
Just like, you know, let's just, you know, turn people's expectations on their heads. Mm-hmm. And I love it every time that Scully does that.
Yeah, totally. So apparently Gautier was the only one who survived, or not survived, but was fine. And he checked himself out, went home to San Francisco. And I do enjoy the fact that, like, suddenly in the next scene, they're just at San Francisco, which is, like, incredibly, it's very far from San Diego. I mean, they definitely had to get on a plane. And I get it. I know in this show, we just jump from location to location, whatever. But it just was just funny how I'm sure people watching are like, well, of course, San Francisco's right up the street from San Diego. Of course, that's California. Let's just do it.
But both have San in the name. Exactly. I presume they're in the same neighborhood.
Yeah. But I just thought it was like, okay, it was like, why? Like, why do you have to live in San Francisco? Do they just want another cool location? Like, why can't the guy just live in San Diego? I don't know. I don't get it. Anyway, he's in San Francisco in this incredibly lovely house, which I would love to live
Very
in.
Very nice. Great house.
Yeah. And his wife comes home, and I really like this scene. I thought it was really well done. It was very creepy, incredibly done, very well acted by this woman who's just like, you believe the progression. Like, I know a lot of the time we watch this show and we're like, why are you being such a dumbass? Like, come on. But like, she clues in right away. There's something off with this guy.
She knows something. Yeah. She and goes then, from, like, you know, obviously being like normal. You wouldn't expect anything weird from your husband. And then, but she does figure it out pretty quickly that, no, this is not right.
Yeah. And she backs away and she tries to run away and does not get away, unfortunately. But she then the alien force, I don't know, we just call it the Purity, the alien force, whatever, jumps into Joan and exits the premises and now is in San Francisco, apparently. But
I guess. Now in San Francisco. What now? Why is it that the alien force, I like that, felt the need to leave Gautier and go into Joan? Gautier seemed like a perfectly acceptable host, perfectly
maybe
able to get around.
She was seemed to me like kind of an unexpected wrench, like, oh, now there's somebody onto me. So if I take this person over, then I don't need to worry about that. That loose end.
I think you could be right that that he was kind of, he was a little bit the subject of attention already.
She was in the wrong place at the wrong time, essentially.
She surely was. Yeah. And I think, she just seemed like, she seemed a bit more anonymous than him, perhaps.
Yeah. Or I think that if she hadn't shown up at all, I bet you the alien force would have just stayed inside Gautier. I mean,
probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was like, oh, this seems like a better option. Let's just let's get on board with her.
Yeah.
It likes hopping hosts. It does. I mean, it's been stuck down at the bottom of the ocean for so long. It's just really stretching its legs now.
Yeah, totally.
Any chance it gets.
So we have now Scully heading over to her old hometown. Or her old home locale, I suppose, the military base in San Diego. Yeah. And I liked, again, this connection I thought was kind of, it was convenient but believable. Like, she was I actually know somebody who might be able to help. And it just happened to be like an old family friend, and she knew where he lived, and it worked out. Yeah. And I thought totally believable. Yeah, I liked this scene. I mean, anytime we kind of get little bits and pieces of like Scully's home life and her personal life and her past, I always find that fascinating and interesting.
Oh, yeah.
We don't get a lot of that with Mulder. We get a lot more of it with Scully, but I just really like seeing it.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
And she's has this moment where she's remembering with Melissa. And I do like that they go back to this throughout this season. I mean, We don't need to have Scully grieving Melissa forever, but it is nice to see her remember and like address that. Like, I know we talked about this before with Emily, like, okay, well, Emily is just gone, but then they readdressed it again later in season five. And it was just nice to see, like, okay, we give her this opportunity to sort of decompress and deal with this. And it's just, it was a nice moment.
I do like that. And it makes total sense that she'd be thinking about it, that it doesn't just randomly come back up again.
Right.
It comes up again because Skinner has talked about the investigation. And so it's on her mind, obviously. And we can see it kind of informing her behavior to a certain extent throughout this episode, which is very interesting and just adds an extra layer to her character. And she does such a beautiful job when she's like remembering, you know, her and Melissa playing hopscotch and all that. It's just so beautifully done, and she's so great. And I love that moment, and it's just, you just feel that kind of, you know, it just gives us a little more depth into her as a person, which is always an enjoyable thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes sense, too, that she's obviously in her hometown, so it would make sense that she would be thinking about it here and now.
Absolutely. So it makes total sense. She sees the other kids there, and it's like, it's all very, you know, it fits together nicely as a story.
Nice storytelling here.
We
didn't give Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz a shout out, but they wrote this episode. Yeah.
Shout out to them.
So I did write here on my notes, I wrote, Scully remembering Melissa, but all I'm thinking is, bitch, watch the road. There are children without the ability to get out of the way, because she totally isn't looking at the road and these kids are playing.
I assume she had stopped at that point.
But she didn't. It kept cutting back and she was still moving. And I'm like, I was like, oh God, is she going to run over a child?
She is definitely looking over there way too long. It's not safe.
No, not safe. Not safe. You know, the last thing we need is a horrific child accident. Come on. I get it.
Eyes on the road, Scully.
I wish they had just put the kids on the sidewalk. I mean, would that have been so hard? Like, I don't
on the sidewalk.
I don't want to be thinking about her hitting children in her car during a nice moment. Anyway,
I had not noticed that, but I will notice it now.
Sorry, these are dumb little things that jump out to me. Let's come back to the base in a moment. Let's go back to Mulder for a second. So Mulder is following this salvage shipyard thing guy.
Yeah, he finds like a piece of paper at Gautier's house.
I'm assuming that's
the salvage broker.
The broker, yeah. I'm assuming that that's the tip that they got from these people. They're selling all this stuff that Krycek gave them.
Yeah, so they are, at first I thought it was a salvage company, but then I'm like, oh, I get it. She is the broker that tipped off. I think we're to think it's the French government, and the French government sends this French ship out to do its little investigation.
And this character, I actually really liked this character, Geraldine. And I was kind of like, oh man, I kind of wish we could see more of her, because I thought she was rather feisty. I enjoyed her chemistry with Mulder, honestly. I was like, I want to watch more of these two just like being like snapping at each other. I thought they were rather delightful.
Yeah, I mean, Geraldine could have been a very dull character, but the writing and the actress was, it just kind of spiced it up a little bit. I really enjoyed when she says right near the beginning something like, I don't type. She's hilarious.
Let's give her a shout out. The actress is Jo Bates.
Thank you.
She was great. Geraldine with a J. So
Jerry to her friends.
Jerry. Geraldine. And I just love, oh my God. So Mulder, we're kind of worried for Mulder here, but at the same time, like, he's very, I don't know, he seems kind of oblivious, maybe too oblivious, to the point where she's like, this guy's not here to kill me. But she's clearly expecting somebody coming, which
does seem nervous.
Yeah. And so Mulder gets out of there, luckily. But as Mulder does, he stakes out the place.
Now, are we to think that Geraldine is, now I took from this episode as a whole, that Geraldine is the sole proprietor of that salvage broker. She is it.
I think I don't think there is a Mr. Kalinchek. I think that's her. Yeah.
That's her. And I mean, how sexist was Mulder to assume there was a Mr.? And Geraldine just kind of plays along with it, which, you know, why not? Just to kind of, you know, get this guy out of the office.
That's a really good point, because I thought That's a very good point, Jen, because I assumed that maybe he had a reason to think that there was a man that worked there.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I think all he knew was that it was called J. Kalinchuk Salvage Brokers, and he just assumed that was Mr. Kalinchuk. That's what I took from that.
I could see in the deeply tiny, buried, misogynistic part of my brain how Mulder could walk into that room and assume that this is a secretary and that the actual person who works there is in a back room, because that's just the sort of way things were set up at the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, she does look like she's sitting at a receptionist position.
Yeah.
She's, you know, sitting at a desk that's facing the door. So it does kind of look like she's a receptionist. So I can kind of, but he's just very certain that it's a man from the get go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going to like throw him under the bus and call him a misogynist, because if you're thinking salvage broker, you're probably going to assume man. You shouldn't, but you know, sometimes, I mean, I do the same thing. I try to live my life as a feminist, but occasionally I will make sexist assumptions.
Yeah.
I'm having a conversation and someone mentions a judge and I'm like, oh, what did he say?
Yeah.
And like, if it's my husband, we're talking about a news story or something. He's like, well, the judge is a woman, first of all. And I'm like,
oops,
so sexist.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just there in our brains.
It's
right?
ingrained. Yeah. And so you're absolutely correct, and I don't necessarily excuse it, I think that's probably what's going on here with Mulder. And to his credit, when he sees her leave, he clues in. He's immediately aware. Oh, okay, that was the chick.
Figures it out pretty quick. He's not like stuck on that stereotype by any means.
I mean,
it's interesting that, you know, throughout this episode, that it becomes kind of a theme, doesn't it? That Geraldine keeps saying, you know, pardon your gender type. They just keep using the phrase gender type over and over again.
Yeah, but it is interesting though. Like the point, like they made an active decision to make this character a woman when they very easily could have made this character a man. It was almost like they were deliberately attempting to play with these tropes and these stereotypes. Like it does feel that way.
Yeah, even your name Geraldine, it could so easily have been Gerald, couldn't it? It's almost like they wrote it as Gerald and then turned it into Geraldine or something. I love it.
I'm glad they did, though, because I really liked this actress and I liked this character. And I thought that was
entertaining.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I do love it. She's the one. She's the sole proprietor, and she does all the shit. And she's
everything to do with the salvage broker, I think, could have been really boring, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But I think because she brings a certain something to the role and to the scenes that she's in with Mulder, that she makes them much more engaging.
Agreed. I enjoyed watching her in all of her scenes. So well done, Joe Bates. Yeah. Well done.
She was not long for the world, sadly.
I was going to say, too, because all these goons show up, I'm assuming these are like the French goons. They're speaking French. I just wrote, like, I certainly hope there was no one else in that salvage building, because Mulder just peaced out.
Yeah.
He was like,
yeah,
all right.
He was pretty sure he
saw
that
them
was it.
Walking in there with automatic weapons. And, I mean, I get it. He was like, all right, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I get it. But
this is nothing to do with me.
No, I'm leaving. Bye bye. But like, he didn't want to stick around for the shootout. And I'm hoping maybe he assumed that they were after Geraldine, which is why he left. But
he caught on pretty quick that she was the target, I think, because he was determined to follow her quite a long way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get back to that. Let's go back to Scully for a moment. Let's talk about Commander Johansson.
Yeah.
I really liked this actor, too.
Yeah, that's Robert Cloutier, Canadian actor. He was also in Red Museum.
Yes.
I gave him a shout out then because I love Robert Cloutier. If Canadians will recognize him from the TV show Beachcombers from years gone by.
Nice.
And he's a Canadian treasure.
Oh, well, I thought he did a really good job of sort of portraying two versions of this character. The sort of I don't remember anything. I'm just an old man. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm just a genial old fellow.
Yeah. He's clearly, you know, playing dumb at first because he doesn't know what Scully's there for, what she's going to talk about. And then it's nice. I love the idea that like this sort of personal story of his is kind of, it seems to tip the scale for him. Like he lost his son, and he's well aware of like what the government's capable of. And I think that sort of encouraged him to sort of spill his guts, so to speak, to Scully.
he turns around really fast from like, you know, kind of stonewalling her to, you know, maybe because Scully mentions his son as she's leaving, that that kind of tweaks something in him.
Yeah.
Cause he changes his mind right away. And like you say, he takes a very different kind of, suddenly we see the real sort of Commander Johansson come out, I think, cause he's suddenly much more serious and has a lot to tell her.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a really cool, like, I don't want to say twist, but I thought that was a cool turn that, like, we get we know we're getting the real story, which I like that.
And it is, and it's also kind of interesting how, you know, she is detained as she's leaving the base, and it's like, oh, God, no, what's happening to Scully?
Right.
Did she do, is she in trouble? Have, like, you know, is the cigarette-smoking man going to come and put her in jail or something? But no, it's just, you know, the commander is coming, wants to come after her and set her straight. So
it was
kind of a cool little twist, too.
Yeah, it was a very effective little fake-out, because, yeah, for it a couple, was,
it was,
for a few moments,
quite
you're
suspenseful,
like, what's happening? Yeah,
what is happening? Because he could easily have just kind of, you know, flagged her down or something, but no, it's just kind of this interesting little sort of suspenseful twist, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, and I mean, immediately, I know, I remember the first time I saw this, and every time I watch it, I kind of have that same feeling that, oh my God, this guy, he means business. He's gonna silence her. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that's
something
what they
scary
make.
Is about to happen.
Yeah. So I thought that was a good scene. But anyway, yeah, I mean, his tale, I think they tell it later, but we should just tell it. Essentially. Mm. The Zeus Faber, which, is this the first time we're hearing about the Zeus Faber? Because I feel like we hear about it again, but I could be wrong.
I believe it's the first time we hear about it. Obviously, in the episode, we see the Zeus Faber on one of the charts on board the Piper Maru.
Right. They
for
find
whatever reason,
it.
I guess because they had noted this is where the Zeus Faber went, perhaps. So.
And it's worth pointing out that Zeus is used a lot. Like, I think they use Zeus genetics for... Season 8 is Zeus genetics, and then I think they use it also in season 2 in that warehouse that Deep Throat meets them.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah.
It's Zeus something. So it's clear that, like, they like to use the word Zeus in their nefarious projects.
They do. Well, it's very sort of narcissistic, isn't it? The sort of great god Zeus, and they think they're gods, don't they?
Love it. Love it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So they were on this sub that was sent to find the plane, and it's clearly, like, I do like the idea that, like, all these military guys are just told what to do, and they do it. And I think that's fascinating to me. I was just watching, I don't know if you have seen the show Jack Ryan. It's this new one on
Amazon. I have not. Yeah, but I know which one you mean.
I just started watching that. It's really good. But, I mean, it's not like this is a new concept. They do this in military movies all the time. But just the idea that, like, these guys are just sent to do bad shit for the sake of their country. Mm-hmm. And nobody is really given any sort of choice in the matter. And there's really no consequence. And it's just something that they do. And I like the idea. I mean, I don't like it. It's awful. But I mean, it's perfect for this show because we need these sort of quote unquote soldiers to carry out everybody's dirty work. Like, we need this sort of thing to happen. But I like the idea that all these guys, these military guys, are being sent on this mission. They don't really know what they're doing. Like, all they think they're doing is salvaging this atomic bomb when they're really doing something far more dangerous, although I don't know what's more dangerous than an atomic bomb, but if there is something more dangerous, this is it.
It's definitely unpredictable.
Yeah, and it's clearly not what they signed up for. You know what I mean?
Not
like, that's
all.
Not what they were
going to
do. So they get
it's
down
just,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially they are obviously taken over by the black oil. The captain is refusing to return because they have to find this ship or whatever. Or this sub, or I'm sorry, the plane. There's a ship and a sub and a plane. Fuck, I can't keep it
there's
straight.
There's a lot of different modes of transportation involved here.
Really are.
Above and underwater.
Yes. So what ends up happening is this mutiny where these guys are essentially left for dead. And clearly Commander Johansson has been living with this guilt for all these years, which I think is a common theme in the X-Files. Like, this is a lot of Mulder's sources, so to speak, is usually these just people that can't quite take the guilt anymore, and so they just have to unload.
Because they've often had to live with the things that they've done for several decades, and this is Scully's source in this case.
Exactly. And it's cool because, this source was all Scully. It was her friend, and she found out. She got this important information, but Scully is still convinced that this is just a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, which it's on the surface of it to a certain extent to be plausible because
exactly.
Yeah, that would be a super secret thing, and that would be a big deal, and you would go to a lot of trouble to recover it, and might explain the radiation, so
yeah,
sure, why not?
It is by no means a bad conclusion to jump to. It's what anyone would jump to, but
sure.
It's not what Mulder would jump to, which is why we have Mulder.
He's got a different approach.
So she's trying to tell him her information. And I mean, again, yet again, Scully's kind of trying to call him off. Like this all makes sense, Mulder. Listen, like this means this, this means this. And he's like, okay, I'm going to Hong Kong. Bye.
Yeah, by the way, heading to Hong Kong.
Yeah. He's not going to let go of his tail. He's not going to just give up on what he's following because of something Scully said, which is very Mulder.
And going to Hong Kong with just nary a thought is very Mulder as well.
And if he didn't, then we would not get to where we need to go. So, by the way, let's go back a little bit because Mulder kind of ends this. So let's talk about Skinner for a little bit. So let's do this. So Skinner is in this restaurant. Do you know where is he in DC? Like it was just so arbitrary. Yeah. He randomly is in this restaurant. Like,
yes, I've thought a lot about that restaurant for some reason. I'm very sort of like interested in it, and it looks to me when I look at like the bones of the place, it looks like a bar.
Yeah,
but it's clearly been set up like a restaurant because the tables are all set like it's a restaurant. The waitress is behaving like it's a restaurant. We're supposed to think it's a restaurant, but it looks to me like they filmed it in a bar. So I think we're supposed to get the impression that this is Skinner's regular hangout for where he goes for lunch because he seems, you know, relatively familiar with the waitress and she seems relatively familiar with him, and he just likes to go to this place for his lunch, and obviously nefarious characters are aware of this.
Yeah, okay, but my question is, like, he's just here for lunch, okay?
Just here for lunch. He wants the blue plate special.
These guys show up at Skinner's lunch haunt to threaten him, essentially.
They do. Yeah.
Because he's clearly appealed this decision and he's pissed off some of the higher ups.
That's right.
So, okay, so we have these guys wandering into Skinner's lunch haunt for
annoying him.
Yes. Then completely coincidentally, we have Luis Cardinal in this restaurant. Why?
Later on another day, one assumes.
Is it another day?
I took that to be another day because we see him come in again, I think, when Luis Cardinal is there, because he comes in and says something like, is the coffee on?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what kind of restaurant does not have the coffee on? But
either way,
I think it's a different day. And I guess, I mean, we'll see more about this in Apocrypha, though. Honestly, I can't quite recall how it resolves.
Yeah.
But
I found myself having a tough time squaring Luis Cardinal's, I mean, he's clearly there to shoot Skinner. I get it.
Yes.
But
yes,
it's just like right off the heels of that other scene where these other people find Skinner. It's like, just everybody know that Skinner's eating at the Red Lobster down the street? Like, is this where we're going to go attack Skinner? Like, it was just so weird to me that these two different, clearly different groups of people happened to come upon him in this restaurant. It was just very weird.
Yeah, I just thought there was a connection between them because we know Luis Cardinal is connected to the syndicate, and I figured that those guys are also in some way at least connected to the syndicate. One of those guys is what I guess is referred to as the gray-haired man who shows up a couple of times again.
Yeah.
I've honestly forgotten who he is, but that's how he's credited, I guess. So they are in some way connected, I took, to the syndicate, and thusly, they maybe passed the word along to the syndicate, hey, if you want to get Skinner, you should totally go to where he has his lunch, because that's easier to get to than the FBI, I guess. And they sent Luis Cardinal, apparently, not convinced after their conversation with him.
It's funny, I'm torn, because part of me is like, okay, well, would it have been better if that first scene had just taken place at the FBI or outside the FBI or something, and then it was these FBI guys that are clearly syndicate goons, you know, kind of strong-arming Skinner, and then we have the restaurant scene where Luis Cardinal shows up. But then the more I think about it, I'm like, okay, well, we have to sort of establish that Skinner goes here. So if we're gonna do that anyway, why not just do both the scenes? This is just me like parsing out the scenes in my head and why they wrote them this way. And I guess it makes sense, but it definitely stuck out to me as just slightly odd.
It's a little odd. The whole thing is a little strange. Yeah. But I thought that there was like a connection between them, although it's not at all clear how one leads to the other. So it's a little weird because it's odd in sort of how it's placed into this episode, of course, because there are two scenes that happen at this restaurant. They're similar, but not the same. And you remember it as happening like on the same day. I remember it as happening on two different days. That's a bad sign that they didn't do a good job of distinguishing these two events. So it's just a little confusing the fact that these two scenes happen in the same setting, in a similar scenario.
He
sits at the same table both times.
Yeah.
It's a little confusing.
I probably did maybe pick up on the idea that it was a second day, but like in my brain clearly didn't process that information as important because I didn't remember it as being 2 days. It's just kind of like the scenes blur together.
Well, I mean, they look like exactly the same scene.
Yeah.
So I think if you're thinking back on it, I would tend to remember it. And I think I always have
as one scene.
Yeah. Whereas it's not meant to be. So that just, they didn't maybe do enough to distinguish those two sort of events.
Yeah. I mean, while we're talking about this, let's just go through it because even though it doesn't play out that way in the story, I think we can just kind of wrap up the Skinner arc here. Mm-hmm. Because Louis Cardinal is apparently very, very perturbed that he cannot get a phone call on a payphone. Oh, these are 90s problems. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But I don't even know if this is true or if he's just trying to cause a scene to get Skinner to come up. I don't know what his motivation is. It is it's an effective scene because you don't quite know what's going to happen. And I do love the idea that Skinner clearly has like a pre-established relationship with this waitress that he's going to get up to defend her. Like he literally is like, hey, stop harassing this lady. Like I love Skinner just stepping in chivalrous.
Is there a problem here? Like, can I please have a Skinner to sit in my office all of the time?
Seriously.
Because the number of times I get harassed at my job by various kinds of clients, and I wish there was a Skinner to say, is there a problem here?
Yeah.
That would just be like a dream come true for anyone that works at any kind of frontline job.
I love it. And I mean, the idea that this guy is giving her shit for the payphone is just so beyond the pale. Like my heart goes out for these service workers who are just like trying to fucking get a paycheck and serve you a meal.
Honestly.
I'm like, really?
And dealing with this crap.
Leave her alone. And I love the idea that Skinner is clearly that kind of person too, and he's going to get up and defend this woman. And I loved that.
It's very hot. I have to say, hot of Skinner.
It is, and he gets shot for this. I mean, and it's not like he wouldn't have gotten shot anyway. I get it. The guy was there to shoot him, but it still comes across like he got shot, like trying to stand up for this woman being harassed. You know what I mean?
The poor waitress is going to think he got shot because of her, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
My take from the scene is that for some reason, Louis Cardinal decided his assassination plan here was going to be, I'm going to create a scene. Somehow I know Skinner well enough that he's somehow going to get involved. And then I'm going to pretend to freak out and shoot him so that it just seems like I'm a random crazy guy that shot Skinner instead of someone sent to assassinate him.
Right.
So he's quite the little actor, is Louis Cardinal. He creates this whole little situation.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool the way they shoot it, too, because we only see him from behind. If we have particularly good memories, we might recognize him from Blessing Way, Paperclip Blessing Way, maybe is the last time we see him.
Yeah.
So we might have recognized him if we saw him otherwise, but we only see him from the back at the beginning, at least, of the scene. And so we don't realize what's coming. And that makes it all the more shocking, of course, when he turns around and shoots Skinner.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm wondering too, when you first watched this at the time, like, were you like afraid for Skinner? Because I'd imagine being afraid for Skinner, like that he could die.
Oh God, yes. Yeah. I was you never know who's going to die on the X-Files, of course. So at first I thought there was a chance that he might be dead. I was definitely afraid for him because it was very scary. And I mean, every time, after Deep Throat was killed, there's always this sense that anyone can die. It's not like a lot of shows where no one ever really dies, but on the X-Files, they seriously do. And so there's always that sort of weight of possibility every time something like this happens. So it was very scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's, I'm trying to think. Oh, Mulder's at the airport and
right.
Is this before? I don't know if I have this in the right order. Does he run into Krychek before he goes? No. He's in Hong Kong first, right? He goes to Hong Kong first.
Has a lovely little sort of like restaurant encounter with Geraldine.
Yes. And the whole handcuffing thing and like dragging her out of the restaurant, which I found very, very fun.
It's quite fun. I think it's a strange concept, though. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm Canadian, that this idea that there's no means by which you can arrest someone if you don't have a gun. I would have thought that the more compelling argument would be that you don't have jurisdiction here, because I'm not totally convinced that the FBI would have jurisdiction in Hong Kong. So I thought that's what Geraldine was going to say. But for some reason, she seems to think the lack of gun is what prevents an arrest. Well,
and she seems awfully sure of herself, too, considering everyone else has a fucking gun. Like,
she's very sure of herself. Yeah. And I got to think that like viewers in the UK where most police are never armed and are somehow able to arrest people all the time must have thought that was a very odd encounter.
Yeah.
So I think it would have been just much easier. I guess they needed to establish he didn't have his gun so that for you know, the later scene, so that we'd know why he wasn't able to defend himself with a gun.
Right. That makes sense. And you're right. It's totally why. But then that does nothing to explain why everyone and their brother has a gun later.
Yeah. Like, everybody like but Mulder, apparently.
Okay, I guess Mulder's the only one who had to turn it in at customs. It's a little weird, but there it is.
The only chump that actually went along with the law.
I mean, that's so not Mulder, right? Like, he would be like, here, take my water gun. I'm going to keep the real gun in my sock. It's weird.
I mean, I don't know anything about Hong Kong gun laws, but that seems incredibly strict not to let a law enforcement officer keep his weapon. Right. But apparently that we are at least to believe that that's the way it was at the time.
I mean, I'm not sure if they themselves, their law enforcement has guns. I mean, I'm assuming they do.
Not. I mean, at that point it was connected to the UK. So I suppose it's possible that they didn't since, you know, the UK, they weren't armed police and maybe they weren't in Hong Kong. I don't know. I'll have to do some research on this.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
But we establish he doesn't have his gun and there is that sort of fun kind of handcuff moment. And everyone in the restaurant's just like, well, isn't this a curious turn of events, but we're not going to get involved.
Yeah. And Mulder didn't even pay for the meal. I mean, he just took her right on out of there. I hope he went back later. He probably had a lot of stuff on his mind.
Yeah.
But I hope somebody paid for that food. I'm assuming these French guys that track them down at this apartment or wherever Krychek is are the same guys at the warehouse.
They seem like the same.
Yeah.
They were exactly literally the same guys or the same organization.
Like just sent by the same,
the same kind of positions or the same kind of agents, certainly at the very least.
Yeah, but I mean, this was a really cool reveal, and I imagine for you two originally watching to find Krychek existing again in our universe, because the last time we saw him, he took the data tape and he was threatening to make it public, but now we find out that those threats are not hollow. He is happy to share these with people for the right price. Although I have a feeling his motivations are far more vendetta related than money related.
I think it's probably a little of both.
Yeah.
Always, you know, looking out for himself, but also, you know, if he can get a little revenge along the way, bonus.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Anytime he does anything, it's just for himself. So I can agree with any of that. So luckily though, for them, good old Joan shows up at the perfect time and radiates the shit out of everyone. And Mulder already has gotten away because he's chasing Krychek.
Yes.
But poor Geraldine is not long for this world.
Yeah, poor Geraldine. She never had a chance. She's still handcuffed to Mulder, like on the other side of the door. And like, wow, she was not going to get away.
I did like Krychek's line that was, guess she's her partner now. I thought that was I thought that was a pretty good line. Considering some of the really terrible lines Krychek has later, I thought he delivered a good one in that scene. So
he had that was a pretty good one because they were pretty well handcuffed together at that point. So that was a good little exit line from him.
So let's briefly just talk about this radiation element. I don't think we
I could be wrong, but I want to say we don't necessarily see this used again in terms of the radiation, just like somebody walking around and just like blowing radiation out at everybody. Like, I think can be assumed it happened, I think, at various points in the mythology to come, but I don't think we see this particular thing again.
I don't recall seeing it again. So, yeah, I think that you're right. It was one of those things that they were very big on radiation in this episode, and they went all out with it.
But the radiation itself is definitely a through line. Like, that continues to be an issue. I mean, all the way up through the cancer and through the infertility and all these things that radiation does to people, like Albert Holstein also dies of cancer. Yeah. Like, the radiation is prevalent. Like, it's there. It's a thing that happens when you're exposed to this stuff. But in terms of like an actual sentient being like vibrating that out or whatever,
being like a radiation monster, no, like a weapon. I don't think we've seen that again. They just thought they were just trying things out a little bit in this episode. I think they were just the black oil was a brand new concept, and they were just like, let's see what we can do with this.
Yeah. And I think I like the idea that like they're like, okay, well, we won't go here again, but the details still track. And we can assume it happened again. We just didn't see it. So let's talk about this final scene in the airport, because this is this scene's amazing. First of all, I have to point out these flight signs that literally look like they're printed out on construction paper.
What
are they thinking? You know what it made me think of? Do you ever watch The Office?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a sign. There's a part where Dwight is decorating somebody's the conference room for somebody's birthday, and he just has these signs on the wall that say, "It is your birthday," but they're like printed out and put. I don't know why, but I immediately thought of that because it looked like that. It looked like somebody literally printed out the flight and put it on the wall in paper, and I was just like, "What
airport would do that?
Why?
Like, it makes no sense."
I mean, it's not like they didn't have it.
They were just plumb out of money for the budget at that point in the episode. They couldn't even make something that looked like a realistic sort of flight announcement, so they just stuck signs up there.
It was really bad. I was just like, you guys, really? You just tripped at the finish line here, right? Like, they literally had Hong Kong signs earlier that were like actual electronic signs. So just insert that shot again. Like, we don't need this. It was really bad. I had to point
really
that out.
They wanted to establish that it was a flight to Washington, I guess. And for some reason, I mean, it really stood out to me, too, because I'm like, that's not how airports work. I mean, that's not like, they're not going to have a permanent sign for that flight.
Or like, what are they literally up there scotch taping construction paper to the wall? Like, it was.
Like, did they have a ladder up and down for every flight? Like, what are they doing?
I just thought that was so funny.
And I think something didn't go quite right with production on that one. Yeah. And they just kind of improvised.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Anyway, so Mulder finally tracks down Krycek. And
sure does.
I got to say, Mulder is not so good with the one-liners and Krycek, because his brilliant retort is, "Why don't you shoot yourself in the head like you did my father?" And I was just like,
"That is terrible. That's a terrible line.
It's terrible, right? Like,
you did my father.
Like, what the fuck, Mulder?
Oh, come on."
And I like the idea that maybe they knew this was really bad. Like, Mulder's always trying to get one out on Krycek, because then later they make fun of it. I think in season 5 when he's like, "If that's my last line, I can do better."
Yeah.
Like, it makes me think of that, because it's true. It's like he's always trying to like say something to Krycek that like they do have this something something between them where they're trying to constantly one up each other and best each other, and it's just
in a variety of ways.
Yeah, and it's not.
And it doesn't work.
No.
It's just like they're both just a little too overcome by each other to come up with decent lines
when
they're
together.
Maybe that's
what it is. Like,
that's how I take it.
There was
hot chemistry between them, in my opinion, at the airport through that whole scene.
I'm coming around on this, Jen, because...
Are you really? Not
really, but I'm indulging you.
I like the idea that you are, though.
But I did think... What I did think it was funny... I did think it was funny that Krycek... Like, he's just going to straight up Shaggy this shit and be like, "It wasn't me." You know, Not
like that.
Wasn't me. We know it was you. Like,
yeah, we as viewers know it was him. But yeah. You know, he's all like, no. I mean, he's obviously trying to save his life at that point.
Oh my God, he's so desperate. I just think it's very funny.
Say,
it's like,
he'll say and do anything at any given moment.
And I think again, to just add to the terrible dialogue in this scene when he's like, I don't have it, but if you let me go, I'll give it to you. It's like, but you just said you didn't have it, bitch. Make up your mind. Like, I mean, and like, I know what he means, but at the same time, it was just not well written. Like that little couplet could have been better.
It's just because they're just, you know, a little overwhelmed by each other.
I think that there's something to this theory because it's like they can't quite speak to each other like normal humans.
They never do.
They don't. It's very bizarre. It's just these two hot boys just overwhelmed with hotness.
And just so much like physicality at all times. Yeah, oh, yes. And then like, I mean, could we say that there's like a tiny bit of hurt comfort at the end where Mulder's like, go clean yourself up.
Yeah.
It's like, which is all a bit silly. So it's just an excuse to get him into the washroom so that black oil lady can come for him. But it's what an odd thing for Mulder to want him to do, I guess, to make him look less suspicious. But it's like, go clean yourself up now, honey.
He wants to see his pretty face, right? I mean,
you got to see his pretty face.
You got too much blood on you. Go clean that off. Make yourself pretty. If I have to stare at you for a 14-hour flight, then at least look pretty.
Yeah. I mean, Krycek did look pretty, in my opinion, in this episode. I thought he looked super hot throughout. So
I think he pretty much always does. So you're not going to get any complaints from me.
Fair enough.
So he goes... Well, I also wrote down, like, literally no one is noticing this fight. Like, it's in no broad cares. Daylight. There's nobody who's, like, looking even.
Yeah. Just taking note of it. Let alone trying to get security over something.
Yeah, he's literally got a gun out, like shoved into his stomach, and it's very obvious. It's not like he's being subtle about it. Like,
no, it's like he tries to hide the gun. Like a moment later, when he's like talking to him, he's like holding the gun in kind of this secret way, standing by the telephone. Like, oh, no one can see the gun. But dude, it's too late. Everyone has already seen the gun. You already had it out.
And you have this guy up against the wall, like between the phones. Like you're clearly you're either in a fight or you're in something else. People are gonna notice. Like they're going to see.
I mean, at the airport, you're just standing around, you're bored, you want a show, and this is a show. So everyone would notice this. If it was in today's era, everyone would have their phone out.
I feel like they could have very easily found or created like a longer a longer area of payphones and like have them back more into the corner or something.
Yeah, or even have it happen in the washroom because, I mean, they're obviously going to have something happen in the washroom. So they could have had that whole scene happen in the washroom, but it would have made way more sense to me and that Mulder would have walked out and said, clean yourself up, I'll be right outside kind of thing. Instead of, for some reason, out in the hallway saying, go into the washroom and clean yourself up, which made no sense. So for a variety of reasons, having the whole thing happen in the washroom would have worked way better.
I think you're absolutely right. I agree. Mm-hmm. This scene, by the way, I thought was so funny. And it's such a quick, brief moment when Krycek is peeing at the urinal and then he sees the woman has walked up and he's so amused. Like, he's literally about to say, what the fuck? And then he gets peed.
He's got that goofy smile on his face.
It's like, I wonder what's going through his mind. Like, ooh, is this woman here to like get frisky or why? You're in the wrong.
It's not even like you.
Yeah, it's like you're not in the wrong bathroom because you're clearly. It's like you're using a urinal, and I don't know. It's just bizarre that
it gave me a flashback to Nick Lee's original role on the X-Files, which was Genderbender, and just kind of, you know, what's happening right now with the gender situation.
Yeah,
it did kind
what's
of.
What's the gender type?
What gender type is this?
What's happening? I just thought it was a very funny moment. And it's very...
He's just really baffled.
It's very blink and you miss it, too.
It really is. But you know what? You so rarely actually get to see Krycek smile. Yeah. That to me, it was kind of a magical moment.
It was. It was really funny. And just a really funny moment. And Krycek, I haven't seen Apocrypha in so long, so I'm actually really excited to get into the next episode.
Yeah,
clearly this woman is now on the floor in the bathroom.
Yes.
Who hopefully is going to wake up and be fine, other than the fact that she's in a men's bathroom. But
and in Hong Kong.
Right. She's probably going to be like, what the fuck did I drink?
What am I doing here?
Well, how did I end up here? But Krychek now is clearly now under the influence of the sentient being. So is this is no longer Krychek we're dealing with. This is now alien life force, whatever. Yes. And they use that same trick that they used in Irresistible when Donnie Faster walks at the camera. I don't know why I just remembered that. It's like the same.
I love that. Yeah. Rob Bowman, the director on this one.
Nice and try.
Brilliant job as always.
Yeah. Nice like little, I don't know, think it's supposed to be a callback, but it worked.
It's a cool shot for sure.
Yeah. I liked it. And that's Piper Maru. I think that was a really good episode, Jen.
It's a solid little episode. You know what? I haven't watched Piper Maru in a long time, and it does not stand out in my mind as a great episode. I'm not sure that I love it, but I had forgotten those really nice sort of character moments with Scully that kind of make the episode for me.
And Skinner.
That's what makes the episode worth rewatching outside of just the mythology. If you want sort of just to sort of enjoy the character aspect, that makes it worth rewatching. And so it's a quite a well-paced episode. It doesn't feel like it drags. It like flies by when I'm watching it, which is a really good sign, I think. And it's not overwhelming you with exposition, which I like, because some mythology episodes do that. And I think generally speaking, it's a solid little episode. We got a couple of nice interactions between Mulder and Scully, which is always great. You know, the P-51 situation. And also back in that, I do like the scene in the office when just before they leave, when Scully shows up and they're having their little chit chat. That's a great little scene too. And from a character's perspective,
oh, yeah,
because
we didn't mention that Scully thing.
Scully's little sort of little speech sort of to Mulder, where she says, you know, I'm constantly amazed by you, which is like a lovely thing to say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, saying, you know, you're working down here in the basement and, you know, that sifting through files and transmissions that any other agent would just throw away in the garbage. And she really is amazed by him. And it's a great little exchange. And Scully saying, you know, you're in the basement because they're afraid of you, of your relentlessness. And then all that line about, you know, dropping him into the desert and telling him the truth is out there and he'll ask for a shovel. Well, maybe a backhoe.
Yeah.
That's a great little conversation. Just like, that's nice banter. And I, you know, there's just a lot of sort of admiration coming off of Scully in that scene, I think, which is quite sweet.
Yeah. And it's a nice sort of progression I think it was the EBE conversation they had where she was saying it more like a, like she clearly respects him, but she was saying it more as like a warning. Like you're like this and not everyone is going to be as indulgent as I am. Like that's sort of what she's saying to him. And here she's far more like, oh, Mulder, this is the way. Like it's like she has sort of come into herself more in terms of accepting him and accepting the way he is. And I think that's a really nice progression. And that is a really good scene. Yeah,
it is. It's a great little scene. And also shout out to your theory as well. And the point that you've made recently that Scully has her own office at the FBI because she knocks on the door before she goes in. And as soon as she walks in, she says to Mulder something like, what did you want to meet with me about? Like she's there for a meeting with him.
Yeah.
So I had never really put that together that she doesn't necessarily work in the basement at this point. But this definitely to me confirmed it, I think. So I was convinced for sure.
Yeah. I think that there's enough evidence that at this point we should believe that this is Mulder's office. It's not Scully's office, at least at this point. Mm-hmm. And she comes here for assignments and this is just kind of where she spends a lot of her time because this is who she's working with.
That scene sort of more clearly illustrated it than it usually does. So I appreciated the clarity.
Definitely.
We don't always get.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say about Piper Maru?
I don't think so. I think we had a really great discussion about it. And yeah. I'm really looking forward to discussing Apocrypha because, like you, it's been a long time since I've watched Apocrypha. I can't remember much about it, but I know that there's a lot that happens and I'm looking forward to it.
Same, same, same. Well, if you guys have anything that you wanted to add about this episode or even anything about Piper Maru or the mythology in general or anything, MSR, please send it our way at XFD Podcast. And thanks for listening. And we will be back with you guys in a couple weeks with another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.